Hi, my name is Kieran O'Kane. This is the Mad Tech Podcast, the fast and furious news for the Mad Tech generation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. Delighted to welcome to our podcast this week, Scott Messer, SVP of Media for Leaf Group. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you very much, and great to be with you, Rachel and Kieran.
We're very excited to have you. You're fresh off some time in the Ozarks, you were telling us. Holidays, I'm assuming.
Washing money.
Washing money, indeed. It was a workcation.
Nice.
Remotely. We actually brought our laptops, our monitor. I brought a desk, and we just shop in people's house, but the view was much nicer than usual.
Nice. Yeah, I'm very jealous, so I'm not going to let you talk about that very much. Right. And of course, my esteemed colleague joining me on the podcast today in place of Lindsay Roundtree, Kieran O'Kane, CEO of ExchangeWire. How are you, Kieran?
I'm great. Thanks for asking.
You've got a little bit of a bearded COVID look about you, I have to say.
Yes, I need a trimming.
Great. Okay.
Thank you for highlighting. You could have said you look amazing, tanned. Your hair has grown back, but no, you had to go for the kick in the ball bag.
That's not what I was doing at all. And anyway, everyone's going to see it when we share a photograph of this fantastic session on social media afterwards. Okay, I'm diving in. First news story of the week. UK headquartered and I suppose startup InfoSum has closed a Series A funding round of $15 million. And they're going to be using this to continue to scale their data platform, which enables privacy compliant data sharing. Probably news released, I would say, a couple of months ago was that Brian Lesser, who's ex-Group M and Xander, was appointed to the board of advisors, but now he's actually taking on a formal role for the company as executive chairman. And just a quick recap of the InfoSum product for those that are not familiar. It's a data sharing bunker, which enables parties to share data for the purposes of identifying a user in a privacy compliant way without having to actually move ownership of that data. So it's a tool that can be used by publishers, agencies and brands who are wanting to maximize use and application of their data without having to rely on other solutions such as third-party cookie tracking to identify users and without handing over the ownership of any of their data, so thereby making sure that they're still ensuring their user privacy is protected. So I wanted to talk about this story because it's really big news for InfoSum at Exchange. I know InfoSum really well. Scott, appreciate you might not know InfoSum so well, but you may well do after they start applying some of their $50 million to efforts to scale their product in North America. And I'm quite sure you're very familiar with Brian Lesser and his reputation in the ad tech industry. So it feels like this is a big deal. But I also wanted to get a perspective from both of you about whether it says something about perhaps some of the innovation that's going on in Europe on the technology side of the industry, particularly to do with solving issues of identity in marketing and advertising, because it feels like there's quite a lot of movement here in Europe for tech companies that are focused on this. So, Scott, what was your impression of this news story?
Well, I'll take that last part of the UK and Europe is generally doing some great innovation right now on the ad tech side. I think they're a little bit closer to the fire in terms of regulation and also not as deep-seated in historical legacy platforms. So everything that they're building right now is new and fresh. One of my favorite companies, Permutive, out of London, comes out of that vein. Even if you go back to like what the French are doing at Teads, a little while back, like some great platforms out of there. So I think that the Europe and the UK is having their renaissance moment of ad tech, which is great to see. And I think it's a good piece of diversity. There's several other companies I should mention. The privacy part, like coming from InfoSum, like some of this is new and some of it's like repackaged. DMPs did this before. LiveRamp sort of does it. Like it'll be interesting if they get around like what is privacy and what is privacy compliant, because they're still tracking people. you know, they're becoming Switzerland. And this isn't just InfoSum. This is several other companies that are doing this. They want to be Switzerland, so they own the data. Okay, that's fine. They promise not to use it, you know, and leak it, whatever that means. But people can bring their data in and out, which means that you're if you think privacy means not being able to identify you through an email address, that's one thing. If you think privacy means don't track me and remember what websites I visited or what behaviors I did or what my household income is, then that's a different thing.
Yeah. I mean, that is a good point, right? You know, it depends a little bit on your definition of, well, like you say, on the lens through which you might be viewing privacy. I mean, my understanding of the InfoSum product is that actually it won't, you know, the data bunkers that they're building won't, have any
instances of AWS cloud. Let's get that straight. This bunker nonsense has to stop. It's not a bunker. It's AWS infrastructure.
Crux used to, Salesforce and Crux called them data silos.
Yeah.
So I'm using InfoSum's own language here. So yes, okay, appreciate others might describe it differently. But the point I wanted to make is that it doesn't mean that InfoSum will own that data. In fact, the point is that ownership is retained by those that originate the data, so that we're the original owners of the data. So my understanding is it's providing a mechanism for that data to be shared, which means that ownership doesn't pass from one party to another. I mean, how different that makes it to other products, I'm not sure. Kieran, what's your point of view?
Let's just talk about the European ID crowd, as I like to call it. After like a very famous comic show here called The IT Crowd, which is written by an Irishman, by the way.
All roads lead to Ireland. Yeah.
Of course. That's 68 million this year raised for ID companies in Europe. So Zeotap, right, so you give some nice numbers here. Zeotap, Permativ, and InfoSum. You know, as Scott said, it's a reflection on the environment that we actually live in right now. GDPR has been here for 2 years. It's pretty much, you know, a shit show. I think Europe is kind of just reacting faster than the US. And if there's a ton of really good companies outside those three companies that are coming up pretty fast. Really interesting companies around telco data, and contextual as well. So those three companies are not the only ones who are kind of blazing a trail. And it's good to see it. I mean, there is some rehashing of old ideas here for sure. Look, I'm delighted for InfoSum. I think the fact they got Brian Lesser on board, Nick's a great CEO. They've hired some good people. The product's pretty solid. If you look at the investor list, it does suggest to me that they're veering towards the TV side of things, which is smart, the CTV, and having Brian on board suggests to me that they're going to go after the sort of CTV space in the US, which where, you know, all the sexy growth is. It does leave out the entire open web. It's great. And it's good for Europe as well to be kind of like leading the charge in this stuff. I'm pretty sure the US will probably catch up in a couple of years when they've been exposed to all the privacy stuff. But like, it's good to see this because it doesn't matter about regulation anymore. Like Apple and Google have already, you know, made their moves around IDs and cookies. So we need this stuff to be coming on track. And it's great to see all these companies innovating around it. And we actually need, I don't think one company will dominate all. I think there'll be multiple parts of this puzzle. Like, you know, I mean, LiveRamp are huge in the US. Their footprint in Europe is not as strong as the US, and they've been hiring people here to kind of go after the publishers. So I think there's going to be a combination of things here, right? Around the anonymous web, as Mr. Casale called it, and he gets the naming rights because that's the first person I've ever heard use that phrase in terms of the new ID-less. Because I think you were at the conference, Scott. I think maybe you were. Maybe that's where you were coming from. I don't know. I can't remember. I think all these solutions will work in tandem. I don't think there'll be one to rule them all. I mean, you've got, from the logged in data, you've got LiveRamp, and you've got the trade desk with their UDID. You've got REARC, which is the initiative by IAB Tech. But then you're going to have the anonymous web, where we think we may have like the likes of Grapeshot and contextual players like in that space. People that, like, there's another company here in Europe called Novatique, which is really interesting. They're kind of using sort of a Snowflake sort of technology, which is basically, it works on a first party basis, but it's not applied to third party. So there's loads of interesting stuff around this. And InfoSum clearly has demonstrated that their product is got a viable future. And I wasn't trying to denigrate them by saying they use AWS. Everybody uses AWS. Clearly, the technology is robust, and it has great application, as it can be seen from the successful partnerships they've inked over the last couple of months. And I think this, for me, this could be quite an interesting application in TV. I think this is where InfoSum is going to play.
Yeah. Sorry, Rachel. So no, three interesting things there, right? Measurement is interesting. Not needing, there'll be multiple to rule, right? So it's not going to be one company. And then the third was contextual, right? So the measurement side, really, we're not talking about data targeting. We're talking about data measurement for the largest part. Even when you talk to DSPs about, what do you need data for, and what do you need this tracking? What do you need this stuff for? Rarely are they actually like selecting segments and talking about really wanting to target people. They want to know, did the people that they reach do the action that they wanted? And they want that in that, cross-channel, multi-touch attribution model. And when you listen to the trade desk, I took their training, by the way, which is free and really awesome, actually, if you want to learn something about how the trade desk thinks about media trading. They don't pick segments. They let their solution just run and see what segments are targeted or are present and are responding. And from that case, then they learn what's working and what's not working. Don't let the humans pick things. So measurement is incredibly important. And don't forget that CTV measurement, there's nobody there yet. Nielsen doesn't really work there. Comscore, these things are different. Let me hop into, and then as long as like there will be Facebook and there will be Google, means there's two ecosystems that you have to measure across, which means that there has to be more than one solution. And you're talking about translating data between these. So the InfoSums and the LiveRamps have the right idea of becoming the Switzerlands.
Yeah. They're not taking a position in the media.
Nope.
This is where the trade desk might fall over on this, because they are obviously a huge player in the media space.
And that's why they're sort of joining on board with Andrew Casale and Index and REARC and, the unified ID 2.0 thing. Like, I think something clicked for them recently that they're really ramping up their new ID efforts. And if you think about Brian Lesser joining InfoSum and coming from Xander and what he promised them, and now Xander's on the block to be sold.
They're an investor.
I think the TV targeting data story that he sold in the beginning didn't come to fruition. And now he's moving on with a second story, which is just data and measurement. I don't need media. So he's got the right story. The first go round of it, though, is just to the wrong, well, depending on which investor you are, to the wrong place.
Could be like, I know that was the signal for this end of this segment.
Right? Time's up, Kieran. Yeah.
I just say it could be the next sort of TV measurement solution, and that could be worth a lot of money. Comscore or a Nielsen replacement.
But whichever way you look at it, it's kind of good news, particularly this investment round. It's good news for independent ad tech, right? And, that together with the recent, investment closed by Permutive, they got 18.5 million in a Series B round back in June, Zeotap, 45 million in a Series C back in July. Like I said, it's good news for independent ad tech, right?
It's awesome news for independent artists.
Okay, moving on.
Spend more money on sponsorship.
Yeah, we've not got any vested interests. Right, second news story that I wanted to chat through with you guys. I just can't leave this news story alone, but that's because more entertaining things keep happening week on week on week. It is the return of the Australian Competition Authority and their news media code. And this week it's a focus on Facebook's reaction and lobbying, which is to say that if the ACCC go ahead and implement this media code, they may be forced to withdraw all news content on the Facebook platform for anyone using the platform in Australia, which to me just seems like the most ludicrous position that they can possibly take. It's been widely covered in international media, this news story, but I particularly wanted your perspective, the two of you, on the link that I shared with the both of you, which was from an Australian news media outlet, the publicly funded news media outlet, the ABC, because it draws our attention to a couple of really interesting things. The first is that if Facebook were to go through with their threat of withdrawing news or news content on the Facebook site for Australian users, that kind of automatically potentially makes Facebook a lot less of a usable and interesting place for Australian social media users to flock. Not least of all, it potentially adds to other issues like the absence of any kind of credible news media means that it might be more obvious to be able to hunt out conspiracy theories, fake news, you know, all sorts of content that would otherwise perhaps filter away when you're looking at, when it's mixed in with, you know, with credible news stories. And then the second thing that the ABC pointed to is that, you know, this is in part an argument about applicable codes within, you know, countries' jurisdictions. And it points to the fact that the purpose of this is to implement a media code that enables negotiation. They're not actually saying you have to pay a fixed price, nor are they saying you are always going to have to pay for every single news media article that you feature on Facebook. They're saying we want to put a code in place that means that you have to negotiate with the news media owners if you're going to use their content to attract traffic to your website via which you will earn revenue. And that doesn't seem altogether unreasonable. And the point I wanted to make here is that they link to an example of the franchise code of conduct in Australia, which stipulates that if you want to be a franchise owner of an international franchise in Australia, or a franchisor, then you've got to adhere to a particular code of the way that you set up that business. And that's in recognising this inherent imbalance between a franchisor and a franchisee. And what's really interesting about that is that, you know, a big international franchise that I can think of that didn't do very well in Australia is Starbucks, mostly, many argue, because, you know, their products weren't to the taste of a lot of local coffee connoisseurs in Australia, but also too because they struggled with the franchise code. And this just makes me think that the ACCC are not in the mood to back down from this. So I really want to know what you guys think about where this is going to head next. Scott, you first, then Kieran, I'll let you loose to rant.
It's a big game of chicken, right?
Say that again. Sorry, say that again, Scott.
It's a big game of chicken.
Like, you know, tractors.
Yeah.
Tied to a tractor.
Well, that implies they're going in different directions. I think this is more like two of them tied together, heading towards each other. I want to say on Facebook's part and for Google, you have to ask, you have to take the argument to the absurd side of like, where does this end, right? So news publishers should get paid for being shared, right? This is their thing and you're disrupting subscription. What about TV shows? What about sports scores? What about local blogs, like food shows, right? So in the absurdity, there is no end. And that's what terrifies them the most, is they don't know how many little nips and nicks are going to get taken out of them. But is that the worst thing in the world? Does it become something different? I don't know. So, but it's super interesting to watch.
Karen? So entertaining, right? Kieran.
I am fucking loving this. I agree, Scott. It's a game of chicken, and I don't think the Australians are going to blink, because it's the one time in my entire life I'm delighted that Murdoch has a fucking iron fist hold over the media because he's not going to back down. But as Rachel said to me, it's not just him. The liberal media and the governing bodies involved in this process as well. Look, the reality is, right, Google and Facebook have got away with a lot of this stuff for the last couple of years. And they've built the business off the back of media, right? And they've strip mined a lot of media business globally. And now it's coming back. They're so big. They're so big. They make so much money, right? And they're actually, during the pandemic, there was a little bit dip, but their stock has gone through the roof. A lot of their revenues recovered and media is getting hammered, right? And if you talk media away or like really good quality journalism or quality media away from Facebook, what's left? Racist Uncle Dave spouting his bullshit racist theories and QAnon theories from 4chan, right? I mean, eventually people are just going to migrate away.
This is
what Facebook don't realize, right? They need to get to the table, right, and negotiate and nip this in the bud, because you know who's looking on pretty eagerly? The Europeans, the French, the Germans, the Brits, all of Europe are going to go, you know what, we're going to go to the EU and there's going to be a law passed and you're going to have, this is awesome because this is the start of an unbundling, right? Those two companies have absolutely got away with murder, right? And they'll say they've pushed a ton of money to media, which is true to an extent, but how much money have they taken away? In they may have given traffic away, but they've taken so much more away from what, yeah, exactly. One, how we give you loads of traffic,
they give a little bit on Google, the one hand, they take a lot more on the other hand.
Every fucking part of the internet, right? The browser, the ad tech ecosystem, the monetization piece, the search engine, right? Like, literally, they have gamed this whole fucking thing, right? And the publishers, the poor publishers, are like, a lot of them just have been, you know, true sort of like bad management or just desperation for revenue or working on a quarterly horizon rather than a yearly or decade long horizon, which is what Google and Facebook do. They haven't been able to keep up with it, right? And thankfully, someone in Australia said, you know what, lads, let's have a beer and sort this out, right? I don't give a crap about this free market bullshit, right? Those two companies don't pay any tax in this part of the world, right? They bounce money through Ireland, that bounces through the Cayman Islands, and they pay no tax. I have no sympathy for these guys at all, right? They're not even Australian. They're not even European. They're West Coast American companies who don't even make media. They piggyback off the creativity and the hard work of publishers who publish this stuff. They didn't invent the internet. They didn't invent search engines. They didn't invent social media, right? They just basically perfected it, right? And they've squeezed every around them. So I really hope the Australians stand strong, because this is the tipping point. This is, I genuinely believe that we have those fuckers on the run now. And that's what they are. Let's be honest. I don't hate them. I just don't like the way they've manipulated this entire situation. And the way that Google, this is really galling me, the way that Google positions itself as if it's the small guy, right? That poor Google, they're trying to take Google out. Google makes $120 billion a year, right? And about $60 billion in profit and pay no fucking tax.
So, I mean, this is just, I just love it when you get in this ranty mode, Kieran. It's so entertaining. But there's two things. One is that, you know, this is the central issue here is about attempt, you know, the code is about attempting to redress some balance and to, in you know, and to require some negotiation in this transaction. And, you know, they started off, the ACCC started off with an open series of conversations and negotiations, but they broke down very quickly with Google and Facebook, which is why they've taken the route that they've now taken. But Scott, I wanted to throw back to you because you shared a helpful tweet with me earlier on about the potential of competition authorities from an international point of view coming together on this.
Yeah, so last night, Jason Kint, who if you follow the Popcorn Wars on Twitter is quite the advocate inside of there, shared something that there is a multilateral mutual assistance and cooperation framework for competition authorities, memorandum of understanding between Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the UK, the United States, both the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission, to form this like Marvel group of superheroes that basically said, we're going to share information. all in the quest for Google and Facebook and antitrust and to support these. So when Kieran says that the EU is looking on and the US is close, like they are literally forming an alliance that is rarely reached. I mean, I don't know rarely. I don't know how often they like form these things, but I've never heard of one before. And this is certainly the first time it's happened in this instance.
Totally. Not to this extent. I've never seen anything to this extent. Yeah. And the one thing I just wanted to add here is that, you know, the Aussies love an international audience, especially if they think they've got an opportunity to win. So, you know,
all this is doing is fanning
the flames of
fire. They're awesome, hey. And it's great to see this. It's just, it's beautiful. It's poetry, in my view.
Right. Time's up, Kieran.
Kieran. Let me toss this in. And I don't know if this is rude or not, but your speech about the scraps from the Facebook table is just so reminiscent of William Wallace's speech in Braveheart when he says, "You're so concerned with squabbling for the scraps from Longshanks' table that you've missed your God-given right to something better. There's a difference between us. You think the people of this country exist to provide you with position. I think your position exists to provide those people with freedom."
Yeah.
I go to make sure that they have it.
Yeah. Yeah. We could invoke the spirit of Braveheart, an Australian played a Scot against the English.
But it's the squabbling of scraps from the table.
Yeah, and I think the publishers need to see a bigger picture here.
That's okay, because that was going to be my final question actually to both of you, is to what degree might this actually benefit publishers? Because they're supposed to be at the heart of this. So, yeah, go on, Kieran, make your point.
Reboot. This could literally reboot the distribution piece, right? So Google and Facebook have all the power because they distribute content across the web, right? And they've managed to do that. And they've basically, and I'm sorry for like using this phrase, but they've cock-blocked the internet, right? You can't do anything in this space without going through one or the other. They tax us, right? So imagine this scenario, right? Imagine that Google and Facebook continue this idiotic strategy of playing the nuclear card, right? And it's a very bad all-in game right here. They're playing very bad poker hand they're playing here, right? Let's say they do this, right? And the publisher says, you know what? We're going to set up our own distribution channel. People will find quality, right? I think this could be like, think about it, right? Ozone in the UK, the Ozone project, right? Which works with all the big publishers. They could build a news app, right? Which distributes all of the best content across all their publishers, right? And they could say, well, you know what? We're going to give 100% of the revenue to our publisher partners, right? Fuck Google News and Apple News and Facebook. We're going to do it. We're going to pull it all out. They could completely rebalance, because then where is Apple and Google and Facebook going to get that content? Are they going to create themselves? No, because that's not how they work. They've got a bunch of engineers write algorithms, build the utility apps, a couple of search engines, and that's all they do, right? People will gravitate, and I have to kind of agree with Jason here, and I sometimes don't agree with him all the time because I think he's a bit hardcore on ad tech, but I agree with him. There's always a flight to quality. Premium content will win out. And I think we've learned the game, right? I think the publishers are starting to learn the game. And I'm so glad to see that they're all come together and there's a backbone now starting to appear on the publisher. And we haven't seen that for years. So it could be a reboot of the distribution channel, which I think that's where those companies get all their power from.
Yeah. Yep. I'm going to move us on. Last story, because we're running out of time. Again, it wouldn't be a week in ad tech this year, at this time of the year especially, if we didn't talk about what's happening with TikTok. So Walmart, of course, have become the latest potential suitor in for a purchase of TikTok in partnership with Microsoft. ByteDance, TikTok's owner, is expected to make an announcement sort of any day, actually, about where this is going. Everyone that's been following this story is very well aware, you know, President Trump set a deadline by which he was going to ban TikTok, which is September the 15th, I think. So it feels as though the market is scrambling around to do a deal before that date. Now, reasons why Walmart might be interested in TikTok. Well, we've seen Walmart in the last couple of weeks launch a competitor to the Amazon Prime service, which is called Walmart Plus. this is their own sort of grocery and retail sales delivery service, which is undercutting Amazon in terms of price. We know they're hugely competitive in the e-com space. And the thinking is that they're interested in TikTok for obviously their volume of users, but in particular for their ability to perhaps to connect Walmart with a much younger pool of users who can't be reached by traditional media channels altogether. There's a little twist in the story that occurred earlier on this week, or it might have been at the tail end of last week, which is that China have announced new export rules, which would apply to any Chinese-owned company that has a particular type of technology. Included in that technology is anything that's got a relationship to artificial intelligence, which they argue TikTok would come under that banner because of the ways in which they apply their technology from a discovery point of view. And it means that ownership of that technology couldn't be wholly transferred to a foreign entity. And this could potentially get in the way of ByteDance completing a sale with any foreign entity. So what are we going to see in the next week, well, in the coming days around this? I mean, my personal feeling, as I've expressed before, is that this feels like basically a fist fight between China and the US over there, over who's got the biggest tech clout. But Scott, tell us what you think.
I'd take the under on anything happening before September 15th. I think we get delays and pushes and it's not possible. Trump will not block TikTok outright. You want to talk about political suicide before an election? You know, most of the users are under 18. There's plenty of users over 18, and it would be crazy. It's also got a weird implication of, you know, inter-country commerce, of being able to separate companies. And I think it's bad for VCs. I think it's bad for tech when this really happens. But that's the larger fight for Google. Walmart acquiring it. God, it sounds like Warner Media buying Xander.
Great idea. An unusual fit, is that what you're trying to say?
Great idea on paper, and somebody can really sell you a story, but you're going to pay, what is it, like $100 billion or something like that? Or I don't know, $10 billion, I think this was a valuation. They wanted like 40 or 50. You know, what is that, your media budget? You're going to reach people through it? No, you're going to open your platform and sell ads through it, and you're going to wind up pushing other things. That's not how that goes. You forgot to mention Oracle as a suitor.
Yep.
You want to talk about companies that you don't want to be giving your data to.
Yeah.
I'd watch out for those
guys.
They're
being sued. They're being sued by activists in Europe.
Yeah. Kieran?
I'm with Scott. I think this deal is going to happen. I mean, I was interested. I was listening to Scott.
Sorry, you don't think it's going to happen, or you do?
I don't think it's going to happen.
Right.
I think that Scott's right. I think there was a little interesting sort of twist in the tale. I mean, maybe you mentioned in the preamble, but the Chinese have introduced a law saying they're going to block.
Yes, I did mention that, Kieran. It's good to know you were listening.
I was listening. Well, I actually think that's the Chinese putting the kibosh in that deal. So, you know, imagine America says this is going to happen and China says no. So, you know, they're not going to lose face here. And I think that probably this is a post-election scenario where it's finalized. I don't think any of these companies are going to buy this TikTok. I think there's going to be another twist in the tail here. Like, I really do. I think maybe Biden wins, because who knows what's going to happen in the election, because that's probably another 10 podcasts to have on the... You know what's going to happen next. But let's just say Biden wins and Trump is turfed out of the White House by the army, which is probably the most likely scenario. You might get a scenario where TikTok are allowed to IPO instead of be acquired. That could happen, and I think that could be the best outcome for it, because this forced marriage thing is going to be messy. For one thing, how are you going to get that tech out of China? Just, you know, how do you unravel all that stuff? That's not going to be an easy task. Does Microsoft really want to have that shit show happen? And then the company being splintered, like, you know, this is all about the US. Well, like, I don't know, there's another, you know, SoftBank are in the news to buy TikTok India. So when you splinter the product out, it kind of loses its value. Like if you just have bits here and bits here, what are you actually buying? I mean, the only company who's winning out of this is Facebook. I mean, Zuck went to Washington, whispered in the ear of politicians, Republican politicians, saying TikTok is an agent of Chinese depravity. Let's get it out. And he wins. Like this is what his strategy is. He either buys companies or he ruins them, right? TikTok is an existential threat to Facebook and Instagram. So I don't know. This is not done now. And also, as Scott alluded to, it's highly questionable what the hell Trump's executive order can actually do. I mean, it's very much untested ground. He signs a bit of paper. I mean, he's signed a lot of papers. What does that actually mean for like shutting it down? Or would he even risk the ire of potential voters before like the US election?
Yeah.
And what does it mean to write an executive order blocking like a single company versus a law or a rule that describes the type of company that you want to block? Right. Yeah. A single pointed attack is tricky because you got to have to declare them a terrorist or something like that, and then you can block them. But if you don't, because we have rules that say you can't work with terrorist organizations. So unless you call them something that is illegal, then you don't have a justification for blocking them. And Kieran, the crazy thing is TikTok doesn't even operate in China.
No, it's ByteDance's international arm, effectively.
Yeah, right. And so I like the IPO strategy.
I think that would be the cleanest way. And I think it would be, it'd be a block. It's a shame, right? Because take out all this political nonsense. This is a smokescreen by Trump to basically disguise the fact that he's an absolute shit show of a manager, right? COVID, the economy, all of the above, and he's creating these little sort of fires all over the place to distract people's attention, right? Take that out, actually. TikTok is a really good product and potentially a really good company. And they've just lost a really good CEO who thought he was buying into a global proposition. This could actually be a serious, as I said before, an existential threat to Facebook. They could take serious money off them. And instead, we've got a situation where the company's being hampered in terms of its growth. And it's kind of shit, really, because it definitely sets dangerous precedent for any other company with global ambitions, because there's going to be all these like political minefields, whether it's in India or China or Europe or the US. You know, it means that any...
Could you, just sort of running with that for a minute, could you see a scenario where, I mean, you know, notwithstanding the technical detail of it, as you just alluded to, Scott, which is how the hell would you ban it anyway? But let's just imagine that for whatever reason, TikTok retreated from the US and just concentrated on the rest of international markets. Could you see a scenario where they do that and just think, oh, fuck it, this is too hard. Let's just carry on with the rest of the world and focus on dominating that as much as possible and pushing, elbowing Facebook out of the market in those regions.
But they've been banned in India, right? So they've just lost their second biggest market. It's just a messy, messy situation for the company. What exactly would you be getting? And the problem with selling just the US is it just completely fragments the product. Like the value of, or the real value of TikTok is a truly global platform with billions of users. And now between skirmishes up in the Himalayas, I mean, this story is amazing. Like when we write about this in 10, 20 years, like the Indians basically blocked TikTok the day after 20 troops are killed in the Everest, like a disputed piece of land on the top of the world. And Trump has signed the executive order banning a Chinese social app of dancing kids, which is effectively what it is. It's beyond bizarre. It's the Twilight Zone stuff here. Like.
And I'd like to give TikTok credit as a company and as an operational piece. There's a good bit from TikTok's Vanessa Pappas on Galloway and Kara Swisher's podcast, Pivot.
Oh, yeah.
And she talks about like what they're doing and who they're hiring, and they operate all in the US. They have like so much security and so much like user focused culture. They're not trying to undermine kids. They're trying to keep them from being bullied. They're data first, like they're privacy first. They have all these things in place that are at the core of their DNA. Like we're talking about those European companies that are just built from a different cloth because they're newer. TikTok's in that same vein, and they're actually trying to do this right. I know it's lip service and it was from one of their people, but I really thought about it and like, they're not that bad. You know, and if you think that they're like leaking data and spreading it out, you're a little bit crazy. Is it possible? Yes.
But you think Facebook doesn't do the same thing? I mean, come on, right? Like, okay,
well,
I'm not
Facebook
saying
has a very proven track record of being very sloppy with their data, their collection practices, and a very unwillingness to condemn and stop all of that. This morning, Mark Zuckerberg announced he's going to ban political ads on Facebook 1 week before the presidential election. 7 days.
What a hero.
He should have just blocked that, full stop. I mean, that would have solved a lot of problems. But
yeah, you know, Twitter said never. TikTok said no way. Right? Everybody, Google even was like, you know, political ads aren't that great. We don't need that money. Facebook though really, really needs that money, and apparently there's a lot of it because otherwise you don't protect it.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Okay, we've run out of time. Let's move on to a brief catch up with you, Scott, on what you've been working at, what you've been working on at the Leaf Group over the last couple of months whilst you've been lounging around in the Ozarks, and maybe just a couple of the things that you're particularly focused on at Leaf Group at the moment.
Certainly. So I oversee two divisions inside Leaf Group. One is our revenue operations department that oversees programmatic, ad tech, yield, audience data, everything that collaborates with our sales team. And then the second one is a publishing division of 30 plus owned and operated properties that we have. One of those big ones that we have is called Only in Your State. They just reached number 2 in ComScore for travel and information. A really awesome, wholesome website focused on local travel. So that's been really cool to watch them grow. And on the RevOps side, the audience data piece is really interesting to me, working with our brands like Hunker for Home and Design and Well and Good in the wellness space. And how do we use this information to help advertisers target our users? And understanding the balance between identity-based targeting and contextual targeting. We're big search publishers, and we have a lot of context inside of our articles, and we get a lot of search traffic. So that is a very important part of our business. And so I'm starting to understand that the immediate context may be more valuable than the audience signal that is then trailed to that user. There's nothing more valuable than the right moment, the right time, and the right person. And that is targeting a user on a page about how to fix my toilet. If a person is on a mobile phone saying, how do I fix my toilet? They are standing an inch of water in their bathroom. And that is a great time to serve them an ad. Targeting them 20 minutes later or 3 days later is much less relevant. So I'm very keen on protecting contextual and how do we surface that to advertisers and beyond. Other than that, doing great.
But that contextual piece, I'm assuming that conversation has become only more pertinent, you know, during the pandemic, and, you know, as a result of all of the changes that are happening in personalized and targeted advertising anyway, moving to cookieless environments, the changes that are likely happening in the iOS, iOS world with the deprecation of IDFA. I'm assuming, yeah, like I said, this is becoming just a more important conversation, right?
It's incredibly important. And as you know, Kieran said, there's a moment for publishers to take back their power. It's in this context piece, and it's something that we've overlooked for so long and given away so easily But it's what made newspapers valuable, right? I have an audience, I have a piece of quality journalism, they come to me. And now buying media is about cherry picking valuable users, right? And so if you're only taking the cream of the crop and you're paying a medium dollar for it, you're not getting the full value that you're providing to the community. So how do we reclaim the power of context when the DSPs have already ingested it, when Google has already ingested all of the context of your pages? How do you work to structure your pricing so that you can reclaim it?
Yeah, important piece of work.
Yeah, and Scott Hagedorn from OMG said, they're rethinking all of their third-party data and strategy because those were signals that led to other signals of behavior. But now in COVID times, none of that is relevant. All those models have changed, so everything's different. And I thought actually what the search intent doesn't need to be retooled. So that if you're on that how to fix my toilet thing, you're that user at that moment. You don't need to retrain your models. If you're buying that page, you're buying that user because they're doing that thing. So the lag in data doesn't apply to context when you're using it directly.
Can I ask a question then? Because
yes.
it connects with the conversation you sort of we talked about in the first piece, which is about InfoSum, right? I think context is massively important, right? Always has been. But the problem with context is the measurement piece, right? So people talk about display advertising, right? We try to turn that into a performance-based entity by using a post-view, right, metric, right? So drop a cookie on a user, and if they see an ad for an Italian holiday and they go within a 30-day window to buy that Italian holiday, there's a sort of a means of, you know, measuring that back to the ad itself. But now that we don't have that ID, we don't have that means to measure, can context really sort of take over from that sort of ID-based buying piece? And how do you increase yields when measurement still is a problem?
Yeah, so context solves the targeting problem,
yeah,
not the measurement problem. And then you're referring to like multi-touch attribution and look back windows,
yeah,
which is incredibly valuable. And I think it's what really unlocked mobile ad spend around 2014, 2015, when TapAd and Drawbridge came out and really showed like the effect of mobile advertising on desktop purchase. What was your question?
I just say. Well, my question is, that's
a much problem. Rambling, Kieran.
Well, not really.
Yeah. No. I got lost myself. It's about measurement is going to be broken. And that's the really hard part. And so I think the net effect of this, if it goes all the way, is that money leaves digital media. Investment in media investment leaves it because you might as well buy billboards on the side of a highway where you reach more people at a lower price if you're not going to know whether it drove footfall traffic or actual, right? So then that's what, when you talk about the Apple ID leaving Facebook, that's what Facebook is warning about, is that they won't be able to track back installs across different app publishers. And the majority of Facebook audience network, there's got to be a ton of app install things. How many Clash of Clans ads have you seen and all things? That's a big problem for app publishers. Will lose those install ads for other people's things. And that's going to collapse that. It's not a big deal for on Facebook.com because they will still be able to track within their own ecosystem or in the Facebook app.
But that's not, but for publishers like yourself, right, which would be more brand and premium environments, right? It's the thing about displays, it feels to me that display has been kind of shoehorned into a performance last click attribution model, right? Which is what Google tried to do, right? It's just like search, but it's not like search, right? So we need to fix, if we can figure out a way to fix the attribution and the measurement piece in the new world, right? So maybe it's more like reach and frequency or panel based, but not like 1,000 people, but more like 10 million people, and then models built off the back of that.
Well, you say you want to fix it, but it's not fixing it, because in the old world, like, you know, 2 years ago, this was still shitty for publishers, right? It was still the best.
Okay, reinvented.
So reinventing it. And I think the real interesting word of caution is for CTV publishers. They do not really actually want to see programmatic media on CTV.
And the reason would be?
Digital pennies.
Nobody likes digital pennies.
Nobody likes digital pennies because programmatic allowed for cherry picking and saying, well, I can, you know, I'm going to buy just your best users for $5 and I don't want anything else. Whereas a TV show says, hey, you got this 30-second slot. It's $500,000. You get who you get. You know, most of them will be your audience. Some of them won't be, but you're getting the whole thing. Rather than when they come in and they can just cherry pick the little pieces, you don't have enough demand leverage, supply leverage to extract the real value of that user.
I personally think that's not going to happen in CTV. I think that there's too many walled gardens to let that happen. It's going to be very much a preserve of the ad networks and bundle buys as opposed to like, you know, impression level buys.
Yeah, I think so, but programmatic's got to be there and somebody's going to break it open and somebody's going to allow it. Measurement's going to be there. And then the value, you know, the revenue that you can derive from a CTV show is going to decline dramatically. Because it's not just about the popularity, it's about your volume and the quality of your user and whether or not they're using CTV ad blockers. And then nobody's going to want to show their journalism on television. And you're going to be led to clickbait news articles to watch on your thing. And
like the good night brain for CTV.
Yeah. It's a slippery slope.
Downward spiral.
Programmatic saved publishers and it also ruined them. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
That is a good place to end this week's podcast because we've run out of time and now we're encroaching into a whole different conversation, which would be a great conversation to have at a later date. Thank you so much, Scott, for joining us. It was a pleasure to have you involved in the podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you, Rachel and Kieran. I appreciate you guys having me. It's a real pleasure.
It was fun.
Thanks, Kieran.
I enjoyed that.
What is it? Come on, you irons.
Come on, you irons. Although, you know, we've got to watch them on TV.
I actually don't even know what you're talking about now. So thanks, everyone, for listening. That was this week's MadTech Podcast.